Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Greenwashing culture, how journalism, the entertainment industry, and museums impact the environment. With us is Toby Miller. He's a professor of media and the author of 29 books, including Greenwashing Culture. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle. Toby, it's great to have you back here with us.
Thanks so much, Maria. Great to be with you.
And what a fantastic new book about culture and greenwashing. I had originally planned to start with the way you started the book with this public relations firm, Edelman. But I think what we should do is talk about culture first and what exactly you mean when you talk about culture. How can we understand it and its effects on society?
How much time do you have? So I guess there are normally two ways in which people conceive of culture, Maria. One would be anthropological or ethnographic, and that is, in a sense, the way in which we live our lives, the way in which when you and I wait for a bus in LA, we know that we have to stand in line, and we know that the person at the front of the line gets on the bus first. All of those things through to, you know, even more mundane elements, but that are quite important, like how you lay a table, where you put the knife and the fork, how these things are agreed, how we learn them, how we organize our daily rituals, that when we go to church or when we're in class, we don't just start speaking whenever we feel like it. We wait until others have spoken and asked for us to speak. That kind of question is addressed by that form of culture. And then there's the more aesthetic or artistic form of culture, which is where those ritualistic norms of daily life are inscribed. So, for example, when we read romance fiction, a Harlequin novel, or a Mills and Boone novel, depending on where you are, or a money, sex, power novel with raised writing on the paperback cover, if you still read paperbacks, then we learn about heterosexual mating rituals. And that's done with a particular style that's determined by the genre, by the publisher, by the language, by the kind of readership. Now, as you can see, the distinction I'm drawing between the anthropological and the aesthetic breaks down because, of course, when we read the Harlequin or Mills and Boone novel or the Money, Sex, Power novel with the raised writing on the cover, that novel is both addressing the kind of everyday norms of ritual and it is also textualizing them and teaching them. So the anthropological and the aesthetic come together. When that happens, for example, in the form of a museum, the museum or the art gallery is both offering us norms about how to comport ourselves as visitors to a museum and ideas about history or behavior at the same time as it is creating aesthetic understandings about architecture, about beauty, and about truth.
So in a way, it's sort of conveying an ideology as well.
Oh, absolutely. And that ideology, particularly, say, in the space of a museum, is all about, or can be about, how things in the past should be understood, but we've transcended them and now we're somewhere else. I mean, if you think about the current controversy in the US over the tearing down of statues commemorating the Confederacy, I was living in New Orleans for the first half of this year and was present when one of those statues was removed. That is about trying to say we have a past which we have transcended, and then the issue becomes, do you want to celebrate the loss of that past or do you want to criticize it? So there are very definite ideological components, absolutely.
And so when you wrote this book, one of the theorists that you spent some time on, actually a few of them, were Antonio Gramsci and the Frankfurt School. They argued that the culture industry is a force of anti-enlightenment or mass deception. And then you kind of sprang from there into more present-day theory. Do you agree with them about the anti-enlightenment mass deception of those theorists, or do you think that it's evolved to another stage?
That's a really great question. All your questions are great and quite penetrating. I want to sit on the fence and have a bit each way. Basically, what Adorno and Horkheimer in the Dialectic of the Enlightenment were saying was that regardless of content, the industrialized form of manufacturing culture, which they encountered when they moved to Santa Monica during the war, was creating movies and radio programs in the same way that Detroit was manufacturing cars. In other words, that there was a standardized norm that allowed for a certain amount of difference in order to differentiate different radio shows or Hollywood movies, but that this relied very much on a standard mode of production with minimal disruption to techniques and minimal innovation, and that that was the enemy of what they saw as the great task and gift of the Enlightenment in Kantian terms, namely, and obviously this takes you down the path of German philosophy, the task of making us reconsider ourselves as projects, taking critical distance from ourselves to see who we really are, holding up what might be an unflattering glass to ourselves and saying, I or we as a nation or this family could be better if we did the following things. But that great task of the Enlightenment and of culture was being done in by industrialized modes. Now, as I've indicated with reference to, for example, romance fiction or the money, sex, power novel with Ray's writing on the cover, I don't think that that highly industrialized model necessarily fails to encourage us to engage in critical self-reflection. And lots of ethnographic studies of things like romance fiction have shown that for many heterosexual women readers, the great gift of this kind of cultural production, however industrialized and quasi-uniform it may be, is that when it comes to conversation about their lives, readers of this material, and the same thing applies to lots of self-help writing, manage then to take that kind of story, be it fictional or pop psychological, and allow it to become a measuring stick against their own lives. Dissatisfaction at the lack of love in their heterosexual relationships, the dissatisfaction at male-female roles, all kinds of things. So yes, I think Adorno and Horkheimer were really onto something when they alerted us to the need to look at what happens when you industrialize culture and manufacture it in the same way as an automobile. But no, I think they were wrong in suggesting that as a consequence, the products, the texts of that kind of culture industry necessarily negate our capacity to engage in critical self-reflection.
Let's turn to your main thesis of the most current book, which is greenwashing. And you spent quite a bit of time documenting and reiterating how much trouble we're in as a planet and how much we're contributing to the destruction of this planet, simultaneous with the greenwashing of the culture industry, so to speak, movies, journalism, museums. Maybe we need to talk about the effects first of the film and TV industry, journalism, and museums. What is the environmental impact?
Well, let's start by saying that most of us would probably assume, as did I until about 15 years ago, that these were comparatively green sectors, by contrast, say, with mineral extraction or aerospace or transportation by car or lots and lots of other manufacturing and extractive industries, and even probably agriculture. And in fact, lots of these sectors advertise themselves as green. And when you see post-industrial societies trying to remake themselves, they often talk about how there will be a green future as they move towards the service or ternary sector, which includes things like the areas you've just mentioned. However, that's not the case. For example, there's a very powerful study of Los Angeles and how within that city, one that is notably polluted by the vast use of automobiles on an everyday basis and trucks and so on, actually in terms of contribution to pollution, the film industry and the television industry, the production end of things, is a greater contributor to greenhouse gas emissions in Los Angeles than transportation. And if you look at the museum sector, you see that one of the things that lots of museums do, whether it's the Tate Modern in London or the Los Angeles County Museum of Art in California, is that they engage in two kinds of greenwashing. The first is that they provide an alibi, one might ironically call it a smokescreen, for major polluters like, say, BP or Shell, in both those cases, who draw upon the goodwill given to them in the public mind by sponsoring blockbuster exhibits or buildings at those famous museums in order to appear as though they are benign entities, part of their search for what they call the social license to operate, so that beyond having commercial and state rights to drill, for example, they also have public acquiescence to do so. At the same time as frequently the museums themselves engage in polluting activity. It can mean, for example, Google searches that are undertaken by administrators and conservators at the museums. Most Google searches are undertaken not necessarily by Google's element itself, but by those who are using it through coal-powered technology. So there's a very dirty coal element to much of our online work that we do. And also because, for example, if you're putting on a major dinner for big donors, then not only are you inviting them using technologies that are very dirty, but, for example, lots of them, and I've witnessed this myself at the Art Institute of Chicago, for example, have their chauffeurs idling the limousines for 4 or 5 hours so they can leave whenever they feel like it, as they prepare to sign or not sign the hefty checks that museums are hoping to receive. So there are all those factors that are at play. There's both the question in the museum sector of providing cover for greenwashing and doing your own greenwashing. When it comes to journalism, there are, on the one hand, certainly the kinds of impacts that come from all the one click away lies all of truth elements of contemporary journalism, where instead of pounding the street in rubber soles to interview people and actually find stuff out in person, many, many journalists are relying entirely on the internet without any sense of how clean and green their own form of energy is, or that of the various routes that the internet takes us on as it speeds around the world to find stuff out and communicate it. And also there are various aspects of journalism that are innately involved in pollution. A famous and very important one is travel journalism. Probably all of us have enjoyed some very good articles by some excellent writers, for example, in the New York Times, about what it's like to go to a certain tourist destination, perhaps even an eco-tourist destination. But of course, what happens is that those writers generally have their airfares paid by the tourism entities that are trying to attract the coverage. They rarely include the carbon imprint of their own journalism, nor do they generally include such issues in the coverage that they provide us with. If you look at all the major journalism federations and unions around the world, even those that themselves are dedicated to reporting on the environmental impact of different industries, rarely engage in any kind of audit of their own carbon footprint. So those are some of the ways in those three sectors you mentioned that I think there's a real problem that needs to be addressed. And it's a problem that isn't obvious to us. We tend to assume, certainly I did, that these are very, very green sectors. To the extent that we know, they're really not.
You actually laid out quite a bit of the environmental destruction within this book, you know, talking about, for example, the health effects of the plastics and wires and monitors that are smashed and dismantled, and this informal economy of rag pickers. How can you help us understand how all of this accumulates and what it really means?
Take a place like Australia, and it, of course, has about 23 million people. It has more than 23 million disposed of cell phones, or mobile phones, as they call them there. One of the problems that a lot of us face in terms of the technologies that you and I and our colleagues at the station are using today is that we're used to the idea that these large or small gadgets work, and then suddenly they don't, and they have to be disposed of. What we're not used to is that they have polluting components, A, at the level of the extraction of minerals to create them, B, at the level of their manufacture, C, at the level of our use, and D, in terms of their post-consumer life. What do I mean by that? Some folks may be aware of the fact that central processing units rely, inter alia, on coltan, which is a composite mineral that basically comes from Democratic Republic of Congo. which, as listeners will be aware, is the site of a horrendous civil war in which millions have died and many more have been raped and injured. A lot of those deaths, a lot of those violations have occurred as part of the conflict minerals industry, which is how the coltan that's in the middle of the cell phone that I'm holding now to my ear to speak to you with is powered in part. So there, and in addition to those human costs, there is a massive impact on the local environment when it comes to pollution of water, air, and earth as a consequence of that extractive work. So there's one example. Another example is at the point of manufacturing. The world's biggest television manufacturer is Mexico, closely followed by China and Vietnam. They basically corner the market. And because Mexico is a democracy, we know a lot more about the experiences of those working in it than we do in the two other nation states. In Mexico, there is extraordinary pollution in the maquiladoras, just south of the border with the United States, at the point where television sets are created. Then, of course, they come over the border. Let's stick with TVs again for a moment. One of the things about the beautiful new flat-screen digital TVs is that they are energy hogs, and they are also quite hot. So in addition to the energy that they use, which is decreasing as the manufacturers become more concerned about such matters, they also encourage many viewers, without thinking about the fact, to be, for example, increasing their use of air conditioning or their use of fans in order to cool the houses and other places in which they're watching the television. Then when a new model comes along, what happens? Well, when we got rid of our old flat screen analogic TVs, where did the hundreds and hundreds of millions, almost 300 million in the US alone, go? Well, they went to West Africa, to Latin America, to Southeast Asia, illegally in most cases, where they were ripped apart, normally by rag pickers, whom you mentioned earlier, i.e. people in the informal sector, in search of the dozens of valuable minerals within them, but without adequate protection against the health risks created to them as informal recyclers by the carcinogenic gases and other properties that are within them. In addition to the horrendous health impact on those people, in addition to all the immediate effects, there are later effects caused from the fact that parts of these recycled television sets, and the same applies to computers and to cell phones and to tablets, are then either buried, in which case they leach into the water table and pollute the soil, or they're burnt, in which case they do the same to the air. So the long-term environmental impacts, as well as the short, medium, and long-term occupational health and safety impacts, are horrendous. Most of us don't think about any of those phases when we engage in the pleasure or the work necessity of utilizing these gadgets. And what we need to do is appreciate that although they may be crucial parts of our lives in terms of family fun or sports enjoyment or going out for the weekend or doing our jobs, they wreak terrible havoc in ways that we can neither see nor hear, but are affecting very materially our lives, our futures, and especially the lives of those in the global south who create the conditions of possibility for our pleasure and our work necessity, and then take responsibility for doing away with them when they've played their part for us.
So let's turn to possible solutions. You argue for a green citizenship, turning more towards a deep ecology where we don't just center on human, we sort of center on the whole picture with the human within it. You see, this is bigger than the nation state. It's got to be supranational. So how would you see this as a possible way of addressing these pretty awful consequences?
One is supposed to end with positive remarks and optimism for the future. You mentioned Gramsci earlier, and he's, of course, famous for many things, not the least of which is quoting Romain Rolland, the French Nobel laureate, who wrote about pessimism of the intelligence, optimism of the will. So this is often wrongly attributed to Gramsci, and the word intelligence is changed to intellect. And one needs both those things. One needs to be looking at the downsides with a serious analytic scrutiny, at the same time as one looks at ways around the problem. And I guess my 25 years living in the United States imbued me a little more with the hopefulness of a Gramsci, as opposed to the horrendous pessimism that my early childhood left me with, by which I simply mean being a teenage Marxist in other countries. So enough of my exciting autobiography. What would this mean? Well, it means recognizing that the stereotype of the environmentalist as the white guy, shaggy-haired, you know, full-bearded, non-hipster, alienated subject who wanders around hugging trees and doesn't connect to issues to do with public policy or commerce or consumption or ordinary people's lives is actually quite wrong. The very significant longitudinal and latitudinal studies of membership of green movements, mostly done in the US, shows that they are cross-class, cross-race, and very cross-geographical. And if you think about some of the ideological objections to environmentalism, you see that it's really a false bifurcation that places environmentalists amongst radicals and anti-environmentalists amongst conservatives. If we turn back the pages to Edmund Burke and his famous negative reflections on the revolution in France in the 18th century, Burke, in objecting to the revolution in France, made one of the most famous remarks that has become a cornerstone of environmental discourse, namely that we have a duty to protect our world, both for our children and for those yet to be born. And that's a long-term conservative tradition. Now, it's warped in the United States by the self-interest of a number of extremely wealthy and powerful corporations and families. But there is a way in which both conservatives and progressives can find common cause in the notion of shepherding our world so that it can be enjoyed and remade by others. So that's one positive note. Another positive note is that there, in addition to being a potentially broad coalition and certainly already a much broader analytic base to environmentalism than we thought, there are some extremely significant moments in the work of non-government organizations, multinational corporations, and states that show the capacity for cooperation across their very different forms of life. To give an example, when it comes to the issues with television sets and telephones and computers that I mentioned, every year Greenpeace puts out a really superb study by its own scientists, often with the cooperation of major corporations, into the green claims and realities of a lot of these gadgets. Similarly, groups involved in militancy in Hong Kong over the working conditions and occupational health and safety of those assembling a lot of our gadgets has been extremely effective in bringing international attention to bear on companies like Foxconn that embark on these kinds of quasi-slave manufacturing protocols. And although the United States is an outlier in the terms of its current administration and that administration's atrocious record on environmentalism, the previous president of France said not long before leaving office, this was François Hollande, we can no longer think of everyday life as a commodity. We have to think of it as something that we look after for the future. So there really are some significant examples abroad of many, many companies, NGOs, and states that are seeking to behave in more responsible ways than we have been used to. There is hope. There is possibility. There is the prospect of a better future.
There were two Latin American examples that you gave, ways of approaching that might be worth considering. One was in Ecuador, the Constitution.
That's right, the Ecuadorian Constitution. And remember, this is a state that for the first time has seen significant power given by the electorate to indigenous peoples in the recent past, recognizes the earth, Mother Earth, and it's gendered in that way, as having rights, as requiring constitutional protections in the same way as free speech or immigration or citizenship rights or rights to cultural expression are granted in many other constitutions. That's a really compelling and powerful notion of how we can hold governments to account in the new kind of constitutional world of environmental citizenship. The other example to which you refer is from Colombia, which is where I work 12 weeks of the year and where I am now. Bogota, which is, of course, the capital, very big city, has for years been maintained informally by the aforementioned rag pickers. These are mostly people who are analphabetic, i.e. they can neither write nor read. Some of them are indigenous and may not speak Spanish, which, of course, is the official and dominant language of the nation state. And so we're always excluded from opportunities to bid for the contracts to be the official cleaners of the city. After some fellow travelers from the left and amongst feminism, because most of these informal workers are women, got together and created a legal challenge to that exclusion that says, well, you can't read or write, so you can't sign a contract. The Supreme Court here ultimately decided in their favor. And so they were able to cut in on the contracts that traditionally had been given to the sons and daughters, particularly the sons of the traditional light-skinned oligarchy that still runs this country. And rag pickers are often the most powerless of the most powerless. I gave examples of people who are picking away at the remains of gadgets. But in addition to that, these people are often stereotyped by otherwise good entities like the World Health Organization and other public health researchers and officials as problems because of the huge amount of really dangerous diseases that they suffer from and therefore the costs they impose on public health. They are rarely seen as solidarity entrepreneurs working together for the common good. And that example is an instance of where, along with some fantastic organization of indigenous rag pickers led by Brazilians, but involving people from South Asia, from Southeast Asia and other parts of the world, have seen how they have common cause and can utilize democratic claims in order to better their situation. So again, as you imply, there is real hope and there has been real progress made by them in terms of being able to dynamize and animate environmental citizenship.
The book again is Greenwashing Culture, and Toby Miller is our guest. He's a distinguished professor of media and culture studies. Well, thank you so much for joining us here again on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you for giving me this great opportunity.